The Black Talk Media Project would like to invite you to become a member of the BTR Community subscription-based social media platform. BTR Community is a platform that was set up for the listening audience of Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black radio network online. For just $24 per year, your subscription gives you access to an interactive space to share information with like-minded people with your privacy guaranteed. Your subscription will go a long way to help us maintain and improve our current media platforms. It will also help provide a budget so that we can begin the task of establishing localized media centers and radio stations across the United States. The best way to show your support and appreciation for what we do here at Black Talk Radio is to subscribe. Help us to help you be informed. Join BTRCommunity.com today.
The views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Lift your eyes up, let your wise rise up, see the signs of the times. If it's time, rise up, when death and hell dwell among all God's people, when those we chose and trusted have become completely corrupted and inherently evil, when the feast that feeds you starves our father's children, when snuff, porn, and pedo forms begin to get top billing, rise up, when famine claims millions, when justice gives blind eyes to billions, when the Lord's anger is no longer feared, if his protection is gone and your enemies are near, if you've seen the seas spill over and the mountains shake, break, and fall, if the moon ever turns blood red and you can't see the sun at all, rise up, no matter if the prize is high in the skies or deep, deep in perdition. If our leaders are globally despised and always seem to rise through attrition or blatant nepotism, if women and children have to live in impossible conditions, if you have to die due to someone else's damn decisions, rise up, when innocent citizens perish for all our sins' sake. If the future seems bleak and your
peace and welcome to New Abolitionist Radio on the Black Talk Radio Network, a program that seeks to educate, inform, and agitate on the issue of 21st century legalized slavery. Hosted by social activist and spoken word poet Max Farkas and Black Talk Media Project founder Scotty Reed. On this program, we discuss recent news on legalized 21st century slavery and human trafficking as it is practiced through the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, along with projects and people who help combat. Today is the June 27th broadcast of New Abolitionist Radio, aired on the 8th Annual National FU Day 2018. I'll explain later. On and near this day in history, June 27, 1833, Prudence Crandall, a white abolitionist Quaker woman, was arrested for conducting an academy for black women in Canterbury, Connecticut. June 27, 1872, Paul Laurence Dunbar, African-American poet and writer, was born. And on June 26, in 1964, the St. Augustine mass assault on African-Americans resulted in mass arrests, unchecked racist mob violence, and the state-sanctioned kidnapping of black children. The headlines read, Governor Farris Bryant ordered 80 more state troopers into riot-torn St. Augustine a day after militant whites and blacks clashed as blacks defied Jim Crow laws by staging wade-ins on the beach. Wade-ins, where African-Americans and their supporters would deliberately go into the ocean or swimming pools that whites had long decided belonged only to them, were apparently among the most offensive and provocative things that could be done to the poor, fragile white folk. You must have been worried about their pure white skin getting stained or something. Hundreds of white segregationists raced into a civil rights march last night, screaming and flailing at Negroes in the cities worst outbreak of racial violence, the Associated Press reported. In direct action news, a nationwide prison slave labor work strike is being called for on August 21st through September 9th. If you know someone inside, tell them what's going on. The last time this was done, it made history. Also, the Right to Vote campaign. They need your support. It's a nationwide campaign being initiated by people who are currently confined in the United States. This campaign grew out of the August 21st national prison strike demands, specifically point 10, the voting rights of all confined citizens serving prison sentences, pretrial detainees, and so-called ex-felons must be counted. Representation is demanded. You can find more about that at SAWARIMI.org, Right to Vote campaign. Our abolitionist in profile tonight is Quaker abolitionist and teacher Prudence Crandall, 1803 to 1890. A rider of the 21st Century Underground Railroad is Gerald Manning. On June 19, 2018, Innocence Project New Orleans IPNO client Gerald Manning walked out of prison at age 59 as a free man, the first time he's experienced freedom in his entire adult life. Manning spent 42 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. From new Supreme Court rulings to a cop on the job less than one freaking day who killed a 17-year-old boy, we have got a lot to cover, and we've never got enough time, so let's get to it, okay? Be sure to follow the information we provide on our Facebook page at New Abolitionist Radio so you can see it in real time as we talk about the stories. Especially tonight, I want you to see something that is an interactive link that you really would be surprised about. Also, remember to support our efforts by joining us as a member at community.blacktalkradionetwork.com. You'll find the links for today's program on our abolitionist planning page. If you've got a question or comment, you can call us at 704-802-5056. You can chat with us and others by logging in at uberconference.com/blacktalkradionetwork. Once again, I'm Max Parthas. What's happening, Brother Scotty?
Hey, what's going on, Max? Just very appreciative to be on these airways with you to bring people very real stories that show that without a doubt that we are facing government sanctioned slavery and involuntary servitude, human trafficking, all that's always been part of slavery. So I'm just very appreciative that I've had, you know, someone like you to help produce, and you've taken mostly the production over. You know what I'm saying? I got so much other stuff to do, and we've had hosts drop off, so a lot of that's been on you, and you've introduced new segments like on this day in history, and I'm very appreciative of that, man. So, you know, when I hear people who say we've made no advances, or they make excuses not to confront white supremacy, but just even the thought, which is unthinkable today, of a group of people telling you can't go to the ocean. You know what I'm saying? Think about that. And the audacity of that. And if you are willing for another person, right, another man, to tell you where you can go on God's green earth. So thank you, Max.
Yeah, and this was the year I was born. You know, if not for this segment that I'm doing, I would have never known about it. And I'm pretty sure some of our listeners would have never even known this event had occurred. And it was such an important event. A lot of these things get brushed over. And, you know, one of the things I found in my research doing this is I need to focus on, particularly on the black history, because history.com doesn't care about black people. I go and search that every week, and it's always something, except for some entertainers. They might, you know, recognize an entertainer or something like that, but it's like they don't care. They don't care. Like, we didn't participate in nothing. Anything that is important is them, and that's history.com. So I use a few services that help me to learn black history, and I try to give credit where credit is due. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to spend the past going on 7 years now with you, Scotty, on this mission. You and the others who have held the mantle of host of New Abolitionist Radio. It's really been a long-term, ongoing conversation. And it took a lot of courage for you to decide to make a program about one topic and not to go off topic.
Oh yeah, man, that was like a no-brainer, Max. But
you know, there's a lot of people out there with programs, and they'll talk about everything under the sun. Whatever is happening today is the latest podcast. In the meantime, issues like this get completely forgotten and overlooked as we talk about what's next.
Right, and you know, it's like every opportunity, the system is showing you that it's practicing slavery. But rather than call it slavery, and excuse me just for a moment, Max, you sound good on your mic, but we are hearing my voice in the background or the speaker, like it's coming over some speakers, and that's when you hear me. So I'm going to do the board. The way I'm going to do the board is I'm going to speak, then unmute you, mute myself. Same thing with any callers. I don't want you to call in by phone because your mic sounds good. And on a Saturday, man, join Black Talk Media Project right here on this very same Uber conference where we give free public new media classes. So that's a quick plug for the classes, y'all, because it's very low participation. But moving on. All right, so we clear on that, Max.
Yeah, that'll work for me. Actually, it's my computer, I think, is the issue. My levels keep rising up on their own, and I don't understand why. So I'll try to work on it over time.
Yeah, that's exactly why we do BT.
I need some good studio equipment, man. Maybe some of our listeners might be able to reach out.
Yeah, sometimes it's something simple. And again, quick plug for the Black Talk Media Project, the nonprofit that manages the Black Talk Radio Network and is a part of contributing to this very program. So yeah, those Saturday classes every 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, free to the public again. Anyway, Max, there is so much to talk about. Yeah, so we might as well jump into the show. There's so much to talk about, but before I had interrupted myself, I was saying that we're supposed to take every opportunity to point out to the public where there is legalized slavery. So how do you not see refugees, some people use the dehumanizing term illegal immigrants to say something again about white people telling non-white people where they can go on the planet. But, you know, these are refugees. Refugees are a result of government man-made problems. It's not the people who created the problems, it's the government. And these are the refugees, the victims that's coming across that border. And with the connection of the private prison industry, as we pointed out, you know, over the past six seasons, their connection to Donald Trump with their billion-dollar donations to a pro-Donald Trump fund, their connection in writing legislation that aligns with white supremacist agendas like making the country more white again. That's really what make America great again. It means making it more white. And that white fragility that you were speaking of earlier, you know, it is still in the ancestors of those who are perpetrating crimes against humanity on this day in history, in trying to prevent African descended people or anybody else from accessing a public beach. So again, we call these things mass incarceration, terms that was coined, and it doesn't really tell the full story, nor is it the most accurate term to discuss what we're dealing with. And so not to see the immigration, the tentacle that immigration and the treatment of refugees has to slavery, is to ignore a whole lot of information, and it just represents an incomplete analysis. It doesn't take the big picture into account, as these private prisons are being pumped with cash from housing these refugees. That gives them even more money to give to the campaigns of the slavers of both parties, the Democrats and the Republican. Any politician or person that's running for public office that's accepting those donations or in-kind donations, like giving money to a super PAC, pushing that person. So we have to other people call it, I guess, Max, intersectionality. So if you don't see the intersectionality in the logic that when these slavers get flushed with that government cash from U.S. tax dollars being allocated to be spent on putting these people into slavery, that's more money for them to bribe politicians. That's more money for them to push legislation that they have written. So I don't know if you knew the human rights or to even the abolitionist movement, which is all about human rights, then, you know, just check out our archives. We got a depository of, again, 6 seasons once a week. So, you know, that's it. That's at least 52 podcasts per year per those 6 years. You do the math. So that's all I had to say, man. We're missing a big opportunity. I shouldn't say we. It's a mistake to not make those connections to what is being done to another people to what is being done to you, okay? And piling on the bully that is represented by the U.S. government and Donald Trump presently. Max.
Well, the GEOs Group's profits have went up by 25% since 2016. And CoreCivic has went up by 12%. Those are the top two prison companies, for-profit private prison companies on the planet. And their business is up 25 and 12% since 2016. There was one point where they had a 100% increase immediately after the election of Donald Trump. And if people remember, he said that was one of the things he was going to do, probably put in about 2 or 3 million people into these prisons through his immigration efforts. So they're building these buildings to do exactly that. They've had the prison companies apply for licensing in order to run a daycare. They've created family facilities with barbed wire and the inward curving slashing wire that you put over fences. I mean, it's amazing to see these places that they're building across the country and what they're doing with those people. And everything that they're doing is being paid for by us as the taxpayers, because that's what they're doing with the money right now, is they're giving it to these for-profit private prisons. And another example of that, Scotty, if you remember recently, they said that the GEO Group moved their yearly attendee thing where they would get their company members together, employees together, and go on a retreat, and moved it over to Trump's golf courses now. And they were the ones that gave like $250,000 just a couple of days before the elections to the Trump campaign, which was illegal, and everybody knew it. Scotty?
Yes, I remember seeing the article. I didn't read the article, but it was included in your on the planning page for tonight's show, if I'm not mistaken. So if you want to start there, if you can pull up the article and just tell people. And I actually heard like the Young Progressive, who upset an establishment Democrat, who I'm not that familiar with, but because of seniority, this man had a lot of power in the U.S. Congress. And so this person of color, this woman of color, I'm not going to pronounce her name, but she has a Latino or Hispanic name, but described as a progressive by people I've listen to today describe her politics. But I saw her in an interview, and you know, she wouldn't endorse Pelosi. She you know, the CNN anchor was trying to hem her in into supporting the establishment Democrats, and she gave, only 28 years old, gave a very logical answer. That's for down the road. I haven't even won election yet. The elections ain't till 2018, so it's inappropriate to talk about, you know, whether or not I would support Nancy Pelosi in the future. So what that question is to signal the Democratic establishment of whether or not to support or direct any money to her campaign against her, whoever her Republican opponent or anybody else in the race might get some Greens in there or something. So it's to make her, and she just handled it beautifully. But our abolitionists in New York, Light Tag, and many others that listen to the broadcast, I say now is good a time as any, whether it's online or in person at some of the events I'm sure she's going to hold, to put the abolitionist agenda on her table and ask her some questions. and get her endorsement of a, I heard she Max. She said she was for abolishing ICE. How about abolishing slavery? Abolishing ICE. How about abolishing slavery?
Scotty, am I?
Hi, this is Sharon. Can you hear me?
Hey, Sharon, I don't know if they can hear me either, but I can hear you.
Yes, we can hear everybody, but Max, did you want to respond, or do you want me to go straight to Sharon? I'm going to have to put you on mute because you're on that delay.
Well, I have a little bit of a couple of things that I did want to accomplish today. There's a speech I want to read from an abolitionist that really highlights a lot of what we're dealing with today. And then also, I don't know if you can hear that too, but ads popped up.
And surprised people.
Okay, and I also want to talk about the mapping police violence tool, which is out. So those two things I want to get to today at some point.
Okay,
we can hear you, Sharon. Welcome to New Abolitionist
Radio.
So
Sharon,
thank you,
we'll
Max.
Get,
there was
get
just
to
one thing I wanted to point out about the refugee situation, and that is that a lot of the people that are who are having their children taken away from them coming across the southern border are indigenous folk. I mean, there have had a call out for translators of Mayan languages and Zapotec and other languages like that, K'iche and Nam. So we're dealing with indigenous people who never should have to recognize that imaginary colonial border that was set up by European Americans. So that's a factor in the conversation I just wanted to point out.
Yes, I understand. I remember a couple of years ago we shared a video clip from Fox News, Fox Business News, where one of the leading investors was talking about how prisons have these, they have these people who are stuck, I guess what's the word for it, Scotty, a captive audience or captive customers, and why shouldn't people exploit it? Well, this is just an expansion of that. The immigration system is just an expansion of that. They don't have even the rights of the 13th Amendment, you know, to go by. They're just people from another nation that they're exploiting,
actually,
and every body that they put in this cell or in a cage or hold for any amount of time, a bunch of people get paid.
Well, actually, Max, if I may, real quick.
Yes, Scotty?
And I'm going to just put you on mute for a second. But actually, I want to point people to just Google, not Google, but Black Talk Radio on our website, on our search engine, blacktalkradionetwork.com. Type in Angela Chin in 13th Amendment as the tags. As I did an interview with her where we talked about this and predicted this in 2015. And I have shared it in the past few days. But she said that this, what they're doing to the refugees, is in violation of the 13th Amendment because they haven't been convicted of any crimes. These are civil offenses that they're charged with, not criminal offenses. People try to muddy the waters, as they say, by keep talking about rapists and murderers and gang members, but that is not the majority of the refugees that's coming across that border. They're actually fleeing those types of factions in the countries that they're coming from. But I am very appreciative of, I think that was Sharon who called in and pointed out, because see, again, the mainstream media tries to control the narrative, and even in the alternative media, in the conversations and dialogues I've been a part of or witnessed, we want to frame it in Americans versus quote-unquote Spanish-speaking people. But as she just pointed out, these are indigenous people, and they even have to search for translators for people with ancient dialects, you know, very old, like aboriginal dialects is an accurate term to describe who these people are. And when I hear people saying that these people coming across are white-identified, as, again, a human being is a human being, but saying that these are muddying the waters, or I guess throwing bleach in it, by saying that these are white identified people and they Spanish speaking people. And see, here we got some information that the mainstream media and the different pundits ain't telling you. They're not telling you this. And even working in construction now, you know, it's not stereotypical to say that you find a lot of these people in construction, because prior to the launch of Black Talk Media Project and Black Talk Radio Network, I worked in construction. And so I worked among these people. And one of them even used to pick me and my brother up, because we didn't have no ride at the time, and give us a ride to work and ride home. Working construction and talking to these dudes and being in the trenches with them, laying that pipe or whatever, you know, doing construction. And you find out they Indians. These are Indians. These are Aboriginal people. They're not, and while they may speak Spanish just like African descended people speak English or any other victim of Americanism, as Malcolm would say, we speak in English, then that does not make them identify as white, because they speak Spanish or whatever. The oppressor has always forced his tongue on everyone. But again, without belaboring the point, Max has some stories or segments that he wants to get to, so I'm going to turn it over to him. But very appreciative. See, that's the new abolitionist radio audience for you, sharing them facts with you. Max. Radio audience for you, sharing them facts with you.
Yes, sir. Well, let me just get this one out of the way first. And again, thank you, Sharon. I appreciate your input always. I found a tool from 2017. People may not be aware of it, but if you're listening, what I want you to do right now is go to mappingpoliceviolence.org. You really should see this with me as we talk about it. It's a hell of a tool that somebody put in just immense work into bringing this thing together. The first thing that you see when it pops up is a map of the United States, which you can scroll inwards and outwards and move. I mean, you can go literally right to your town or city or your neighborhood. And it shows you where people were killed by police, how many people were killed by police, the rate of people that are killed by police. It's got names, it's got dates, it's got officers' names, it's got everything you could possibly imagine on a research way. And the study that they put together, some of the work has produced amazing factoids. You know, if you want to really learn more about just how bad things have become, check this out, and also check out your own area and some of the links that lead to other presentations that they have which are part of this. For instance, it says police killed 1,147 people in 2017. Black people were 25% of those killed, 25%, despite being only 13% of the population. And here's another one that, like, it's a little thing you would never thought of, but there were only 14 days in 2017 where police did not kill someone. Only 14 days out of 365 where nobody got killed by a cop. They say that black people are the most likely to be killed by police. They're three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. And 30% of black victims who were shot by police in 2015 were unarmed. 30% were unarmed. They say where you live matters. And it's also very interactive in that section, too. So you can go and check out your own area, and it will tell you exactly what the statistics in your area are. For instance, you're seven times more likely to be killed by police in Oklahoma than you are in Georgia. So black people don't want to go to Oklahoma too much. You know what I mean? Seven times more likely to be killed by police in Oklahoma than Georgia. And they say that 13 of the 100 largest U.S. city police departments kill black men at higher rates than the U.S. murder rate. So the police are killing people in the top 100 police departments at a higher rate than the entire nation's murder rate. It's just amazing. And again, they have their facts to back it up, the names, the places, the times, the dates. There's one particular page that I pulled up on mapping police violence, where, you know, I was looking at my state, South Carolina, and see how it stood up, and I ended up here where they showed some of the key findings in that particular segment of information. It says that 27% of U.S. police killings between January 2013 and December of 2017 were committed by police departments of the 100 largest U.S. cities. Black people were 39% of people killed by these 100 police departments, despite being only 21% of the population in their jurisdictions. Now, they rounded off that 21%, but I know there are a lot of states where we're 4%, 2%, 5%, and these same rates apply there. 39% of the people killed, man. How does 13% provide 39% of the people killed? They say only one, just one, of the 100 largest city police departments did not kill anyone from January 2013 to December of 2017. And that unique achievement belongs to Irvine, California. Just one police department. 48% of unarmed people killed by the 100 largest city police departments were black. 48% of the unarmed people were black. These police departments killed unarmed black people at a rate four times higher than unarmed white people. Rates of violent crime in cities did not make it any more or less likely for police departments to kill people. So it didn't matter what the crime rate, you still have your own rate of killing people that you maintain. For example, Buffalo and Newark police departments had low rates of police violence despite high crime rates, while Spokane and Bakersfield had relatively low crime rates and high rates of police violence. And it just goes in detail on and on. And as I said, it's very intricate. You could just hover over certain sections and it'll give you the data. You could slide left to right. It'll give you names, dates, places. An amazing tool for researchers and people that just want to understand and look at the data themselves. It's available here. That is mappingpoliceviolence.org. Scotty?
Thank you, Max, for that information. And you asked a question, and you asked, why do black people represent the percentages that you called out, while being told that, you know, we're 13% of the national population, you know. But again, I wouldn't trust a slave catcher to give me accurate numbers. It's a fact that they're not federally required to report. So you're trusting the slave catcher to be honest with you about how many people they killing out here in the streets. So that's not my feelings. That's not something I'm making up. That's a fact. It's been documented over six seasons of New Abolitionist Radio. I also know that everybody don't participate in the census. It's a lot of people who just don't. I can't give you any percentages because they don't participate, so nobody knows, you know. So, but I doubt the federal government's getting 300 plus million census forms or accurate counting of the population of the United States. So I just wanted to make those quick notes. But getting back to your question, we're talking about intersectionality of slavery and white supremacy. There's as some people would say, a linear timeline of slavery, introduction of white supremacy, and those two been getting down like Sonny and Cher ever since. You know, oh yeah, they did get a divorce, but anyway, Max.
Yeah, they did get a divorce, but anyway, Max.
Well, you're also pointing out to something that is called the fallacy of the average. And the fallacy of average is what you see right here, even in this thing that is built to help fight police brutality and police violence. You still find a fallacy in it called the fallacy of the average. The fallacy of the average is based on the false notion that the effects of a thing averaged out on a large scale is equivalent to an effect of the same thing on a small scale. So where they say 48% in one county might be 100%, might be 80%, in another county might be 60%, and they're just averaging it out. So the county with the least is from the county with the least to the county with the most, they go in the middle. But, you know, we find in a lot of these incidents in certain communities that are specifically targeted, like in Milwaukee, which you talked about in BTR News yesterday with the brother there. My heart goes out to him. But in Milwaukee, more than one in two black men are expected to spend time in prison. More than one. How the hell do you explain that to your children if you're raising children in Milwaukee? Well, listen, we got three kids, honey. They're three boys. More than one in two is going to go. What are you going to say to them?
Racism, white supremacy.
So the fallacy of the average is included in that. You have to be careful and be aware that even though it says the average is 48%, right down the street from you, it might be 100%.
Hey, let me simplify things for you. And again, the slave catcher is not going to be give you an accurate accounting. They're not required to by federal law. I do recall that some proposals was made, or some bills or what have you were tabled in committee, but they didn't make it, you know, to the POTUS's desk to sign into law. So let's simplify it. Here's the simplest way to look at it. Look at it as Americans in a codified manner, as American citizens being killed. And then, you know, how many are American citizens and then how many are refugees? That's the best way to simplify it. Non-American, because they're just killing everybody, really. So is it 100% or 80% American citizens? Is it 20% refugees? I saw a story of them shooting down a melanated woman who had come across, and I heard another story. I didn't, you know, exactly get the details on and if it's true or not, I got to vet it, but a refugee mother who was pregnant being injured. I just have that to add, Max. I'll toss it back to you.
A good example of that, Scotty, would be when we first started with New Abolitionist Radio, the word was that it was $280 billion a year that we spend to incarcerate people all across America. And that was what everybody was talking about, $280 billion. And you and I talked, and we started putting the numbers together ourselves, and we were like, yo, this is more like half a trillion than $280 billion. And
hey,
then
Max,
we found out that
Max,
we were right. And Max. Then we waited a couple of years, and another report came out and said, no, the cost of incarceration in the U.S. is more than $1 trillion. So, yeah, whenever they tell you it's $280 billion, it can go up to over $1 trillion.
Max, let me correct myself in the language that
but
I
you don't hear that number no more.
That I just used. I'm sorry, Max. I had to mute you. It seemed like you couldn't hear me. But I do want to make a quick correction. Codification, calling yourself an American versus a refugee and how many of them are getting killed. The proper codification would be under human rights. As Dr. King moved beyond civil rights, that got us so far, that might can get you a few million dollars for the violation of those rights. But ultimately, Dr. King moved on to human rights. That's the path that Malcolm X was on, and other, you know, leaders in the movement for, including the so-called American Negro, as they was called back down, taking their cases before an international body. I just want to add that quick correction. We're talking about human rights. We ain't talking about American rights. We ain't talking about refugee rights. We ain't talking about any other kind of rights except for human rights. So gotta make that clarification.
Right, Scotty? Am I on? Can you hear me?
Yes, Max. Whenever you hear your line unmute, that means you're on. And if I stop talking, so we're able to hear
okay.
You. I'm working the board.
I don't hear that. So just say my name when you're done. Just say my name like I'm doing you, and that'll work. Yeah, just say my name when I'm done like I'm doing you, and that'll be it. So that means come on in. All right. Well, what did you guys think of the prison? I mean, the link that I just provided for you a little while ago that I read some of the statistics from. Anything that you want to say about that, Scotty?
No, Max, because I know we got limited time. I've said enough. I mean, if any other callers want to chime in at number 704-802-5056, hit **.
Okay, well, then what I'll do is go into our next story, which is an update. And it's the story comes from CBS News. It says Pittsburgh, the East Pittsburgh police officer who fatally shot 17-year-old Antoine Rose Jr. on Juneteenth, has been charged with criminal homicide. According to court records, East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosefeld was formally charged Wednesday morning. In a crime complaint filed in the case, detectives cite witnesses who said Rose clearly had nothing in his hands when he was shot, contradicting what Rosefeld initially told investigators. Rose's family stood by, crying and wearing shirts that read "Justice for Antoine," as their attorney spoke at press conference Wednesday. Attorney Lee Merritt said the family is cautiously optimistic about the charge being filed, but said criminal charges alone are going to be insufficient. "We are in it for the long haul to see this process through to conviction," Merritt said. Rosefeld was conducting a traffic stop of the vehicle Rose was riding in, which police say fit the description of one used in a drive-by shooting that night. He told investigators he had ordered the driver out of the car and down on the ground when Rose got out of the vehicle. According to Allegheny County District Attorney Stephen Zabala Jr., Rose can be seen on witness video showing his hands before fleeing. No weapon was found on his person. Rosefeld first told investigators that Rose turned his hand toward Rosefield, who saw something dark that he perceived as a gun. Detectives wrote in the complaint, but when asked to repeat his version of events, Rosefeld's story changed, detectives wrote. During that rendition, Rosefeld told the detectives that he did not see a gun when the passenger emerged and ran. When confronted with his inconsistency, Rosefeld stated he saw something in the passenger's hand, but was not sure what it was, detectives wrote in the complaint. In addition, Officer Rosefeld stated that he was not certain if the individual who had his arm pointed at him was still pointing at him when he fired the shots. Rosefeld opened fire, striking Rose three times from behind, in the back. Rose died from injuries. You can read the rest of that on New Abolitionist Radio, but I also want to point out another thing, that this guy had just gotten the damn job that day. He was like, literally had just put on a uniform that day. It was his first day out, and the very first thing that he does is what? Shoot a black kid, 17 years old, unarmed, and know he's unarmed, three times in the back, and then lie about it, and then get backup from other officers to help him lie about it until the damn video came out to show that he was lying. Man, it just reminds me so much of the reason that I started this fight back with Lawrence Myers in 1995. Same circumstances. Guy just got the job, ran up on a teenager, and shot him in the back of the head. How many kids we got to lose, man? Y'all can figure out how to get to the moon, but you can't figure out how not to kill people. Scotty?
Yeah, Max, I saw the video when it first came out. It was a very short clip. This guy shot him. Yeah, the first I saw it was, one of those local online news stations that's local to that area, and they chopped up the video so bad. The video was shot by a young black woman who added her commentary like, "Why they shooting? Why they shooting at him? Why?" And they just totally edited out her comments, maybe showed 5 seconds at the most. And that account that you heard from this slave catcher that gunned down this 17-year-old high school student, he's lying. At no point, when I saw the video, and then it was Tariq Nasheed who had a copy of the original with the black woman's commentary, who was in an apartment directly looking over it and was shooting her video of the interaction. And the kid never pointed his hand back. He was just running from him. That's why he got hit square in the back three times, you know. And he was running from him, wasn't even looking back, just darted. The other guy ran. He saw his opportunity to run. Don't ask me questions. You can't ask him questions because he dead. But he decided to run. No threat, not in a furtive manner, unless you're going to consider somebody running away from you as a furtive movement. But no, there was nothing in that video I saw to give indication that this 17-year-old student meant to do anything other than to escape the slave catcher's clutches. Max.
Exactly, Scotty. All right, well, I'm going to go on to the next story, and it's really another update, and it's a message from Brother Kinetic Justice. We have been in communications for a while now, and he's been listening to New Abolitionist Radio and actually applying some of what he learns here in his fight. And he's published today in the San Francisco Bay View, which is a longstanding abolitionist newspaper, even fighting today to end slavery. And I want to just read a little bit of what he wrote in the paper in the message to us. He says, to be in balance with the universal order, myself and hundreds of men confined within the Alabama DOC, Department of Corrections, decided to become the change we wanted to see. From 14 throughout 15 and 16, we worked tirelessly fanning that flicker, networking, mobilizing, and organizing and educating into a flame. 2.5 years later, in a coordinated effort from Alabama to Ohio and all across the nation, that flicker turned into the national prison strike on the 45th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion. Our unity, our message, our methods, our execution shook the economical underpinnings and exposed the continued inhumanities of America's dirty little secret, slavery. As a matter of law, the peculiar institution draped in the clothes of the American policing and criminal justice system never ended. But as historical analysis reveals, all attacks against the institution will be met with extreme repression. True to form, due to our attack upon that peculiar institution, many comrades across the country are enduring the brunt of repression. Ra, salute to Comrade Malik, Brother Rashid, Imam Hassan, Brother Anthony Robinson, Brother Benu, and dozens of other brothers and sisters. He says, and I'll end it here, I myself can be counted amongst that number, as many of my ordeals prior to and since the September 9, 2016 demonstration have been widely documented and publicized. To my extreme benefit, in the weeks leading to the national prison strikes, I received a special visit from the law firm of Guest, Bass & Johnson, representatives of the National Lawyers Guild. So shout out to Brother Kinetic Justice for holding it down out there, a man ahead of his time, doing more on the inside than most people do on the outside. Scotty?
I have nothing to add to those eloquent words. So, Max, I'm tossing it right back to you. Good job. Good job, Kinetic Justice. Excellent prose.
Good job, Kinetic Justice. Excellent prose.
Okay, Scotty, then, if that's the case, what I want to do is, as I said, there's a speech I want to read before the night is over. It takes about 2 or 3 minutes. So you give me an idea when you think I should do that. In the meantime, there's a video or two that I'd also like to play so we can hear what the contents are and maybe discuss them. So what I'm going to do now is put the link to the first video up, and it's about 5 minutes worth that we want to hear after that, man. But the first 5 minutes, I really want you to hear, it's about illegal slavery that's being done by American corporations on a global level. So, you know, we talk a lot here about illegal slavery, but there is, I mean, we talk about legal slavery, but there is illegal slavery, too, being done by the same exact corporations. So, Scotty, if you want to click that, we'll play it.
Here to Actor Tonight, the comedy show where Americans in America covering American news are called foreign agents. As we're told to never take our eyes off Donald Trump, whether you're for him, against him, apathetic, whatever the fuck, the message is clear: do not talk about anything other than Trump. As we all run around these days like chickens with our heads cut off, or Americans with our meds cut off, while the lizard brain pandemonium continues,
tonight does use,
I'd instead like to remind you that this is a wonderful time for corporate corruption and control. It's a goddamn dance around the maypole for the massive corporations that really run things. Like a robber who pulls the fire alarm to distract everyone. They are more than happy that you've got your eyes glued to Trump. Let's take a moment to focus on just one of these corporations. Nestle, one of the largest food and water exploiters on the planet. We learned something this week about the ongoing lawsuit against them by 6 citizens from Mali who were once enslaved on African cocoa farms and first filed against the food giants in 2005. The complaint asserts claims of forced labor, torture, cruel and inhumane treatment, and unjust enrichment against Nestle and Cargill, who it says dominate 70% of the world's cocoa market. Slave labor? That's outrageous. That's ridiculous. That's what Nestle admitted to a couple of years ago in Thailand. The enslaved fishermen that Nestle subsidiaries used said sometimes the net is too heavy and the workers get pulled into the water and just disappear. Nestle uses slave laborers that sometimes disappear. You don't see that on the fucking Kit Kat commercials, do you? Not once. Actually, the fish and shrimp from these slave laborers is often used in the Nestle-owned pet foods like Fancy Feast. Yes, can any feast be considered fancy if it doesn't involve at least a wee touch of wrongful death? You know, my cat is very finicky. She won't eat anything that doesn't have slavery involved at some point. Despite their admission about the fishing industry, Nestle is continuing to fight these Mali cocoa workers. In March 2017, Judge Wilson dismissed the case for a second time, finding that Nestle and Cargill had engaged in standard international business practices. There's no crime here. Slave labor is just a standard international business practice. While that sounds bananas, they're not wrong. Unfettered capitalism is a system based on exploitation over empathy. So why should we be surprised that the biggest corporations are successful because of exploitation? They've played the game correctly, and we're acting shocked. Honestly, it's like working in the porn industry and being surprised to see tits. You know, and then someone sues the actress for showing her tits, and then she's like, well, yes, I did show them, but it is an international pornographic business practice, and we are working to decrease the amount of tit display, though. That's what Nestle wants you to think. We're trying to decrease the amount of slave and child labor we use. It's just really tough. For Nestle, quitting slave labor is like quitting smoking. You know, you know you should, but then you have a couple of drinks and you're trying to impress some friends. So you're like, oh, okay, I'll enslave one person, just one person, like a small one, like a little guy, you know? And I won't do it again until my birthday or something, special occasion, you know? So the Mali workers appealed the decision, but Nestle's counsel, Theodore J. Esquire, blah, 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 smarty pants, dick face, pushed back, arguing that slavery in Africa is too far removed from the United States for the companies to be held liable. Yeah, the physical and emotional assault on people by our corporation can't be illegal because it was way over there. I can't even see it. It's in Africa. What happens in Africa stays in Africa, except for natural resources. And besides, name one other time that white people have abused or exploited Africans. It's unheard of.
Max.
All right, that's enough for there. I want to hear what you got to think. Yes, Scotty.
Well, none of this is surprising to me, as I do follow people who have been looking at this, what you might think is illegal slavery, but I mean, it's like Hillary Clinton told the multinational corporations after the U.S.-backed military coup overthrowing their president, and she gave press conference saying Honduras is now open for business. Slavery is international, legal, and again, the UN Convention on Human Rights does outlaw slavery. It says slavery in all its forms, so that pretty much covers everything. But there's no enforcement of this very key provision in the Declaration of Human Rights. There's no Security Council meetings talking about some resolutions to go into these countries and arrest these Nestle executives and any of the nationals who are working with these slavers to enslave these children and adults. So they're not taking it serious, and there's just no enforcement. So this is why you cannot sit back and, well, let me put it this way, non-participation it's not even an option. Because it's just going to keep encroaching, encroaching, encroaching until, I mean, we're already at the highest enslavement. And we just include all, not even try to make a distinction between the legal slavery or prison slavery, which has models in Africa, Ugandans picking cotton. You know, reviving the national cotton export by using prison slave labor. Again, these are international corporations who are influencing these different countries to adopt the model of slavery. So it's legal and it's both illegal. And there's a united front there. There's no reason for there to be any disagreement between another person, because I'm not going to say to another person, I have in the past, but I can't say, why don't you consider prison slavery, but you're talking about these corporations using slavery. No, I should say, have you considered the correlations and the connections and the intersectionality of both legal and illegal slavery? Because these very same companies like Nestle, so again, you know that name. You shouldn't be buying Nestle water no more. You shouldn't be buying Nestle chocolate products. You shouldn't be buying anything from a company. So you had to find, I guess, get the store-bought brand if you must have chocolate. But how far are you willing to go to say you're against these things? If we want to talk about non-participation, then we shouldn't participate in enriching slavers. That's the least you can do. But, I mean, the state of the world is, we're in very dire situation. If we want to be realistic about it and just look at this as a general would on a battlefield or as an abolitionist would in the 1800s, it's terrible. It's international, and these governments are colluding with these corporations to practice slavery, both legal and illegally. So I'll leave it there and I'll toss it back to you, Max.
All right, Scotty. Just a couple of things that I would like to point out that occurred on that video. First of all, we're talking about using slave labor and child labor, and an international American-owned corporation is doing. Throughout the video, he showed the copies of the documents and the legal arguments in court, even to the point where on Nestle's own website, they had their lawyers asking the question that nobody has probably ever asked before, that being, what is child labor? You got to ask what child labor is, huh? I mean, as you pointed out, Scotty, there's nobody to enforce this crime against humanity. And as they said in their arguments, that's the problem right there. These are just standard business practices, standard international business practices. If Mali or if Indonesia has slaves available and we go and exploit that slave labor and those human bodies, we cannot be held accountable. And so morals and ethics are thrown right out the window when it comes to making money. Again, there's a connection here. We're talking about an American corporation, Nestle, you know, the chocolate company, and everything else that they do. And they're also very likely a participant in ALEC, the American Legislation Exchange Council, which some people call the American Legislators Exemplifying Corruption. But in any case, these are where private industries work together with legislators to write laws. And if you watch the film called 13th by Ava DuVernay, then you can see clearly that on occasion, legislators have actually read the laws that they want to put through the House out loud, verbatim, written by the prison company with their damn logo right at the top of it. It's a connection that we need to pay attention to. And then also, if these American corporations would use international slavery and child slave labor, they'd do anything here, especially when it comes to investing in promoting and building up for-profit private prisons, which basically do the same damn thing. I'd like to hear your thoughts. We're 2 minutes away from the break, so let's take a break. And when we come back on the other side, if you have some questions or comments, I'd like to hear from you. You're listening to New Abolitionist Radio right here on the Black Talk Radio Network, and we'll be right back after these messages.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Peace and welcome back to New Abolitionist Radio. If you're already on the uberconference.com chat line, just press ** to unmute yourself. And if you're listening in, you can call in from, if you're listening to the link, you can call in and talk to us at, let me pull up my phone number here, at 704-802-5056, 704-802-5056. Please mind your background noise. Scotty?
Yes, Max, we can move on to the next story. But again, you know, Alec, let me just, add anything, Max, I would just make the point of a clarification that Nestle can be a part of Alec. And you may not recognize them, not you personally, Max, but the public may not recognize them as a prison, a slavery corporation, a private prison slavery corporation like the GEO Group or Core Civic. They are in league with those companies. And why wouldn't they be when they're, you know, have international practices of slavery in various countries? Again, in violation of UN law, the Declaration of Human Rights. So, you know, of course, we got to say that the UN is allowing slavery. And of course, that was clear after Libya. And all of these reports about the auctions, we're talking the same kind of slavery, same kind of illegal slavery. That's it. That's because slavery wasn't legal in Libya before they murdered Gaddafi. So, you know, I just made that point of clarification. I toss it back to you, Max.
All right, Scotty. And again, anybody that wants to chime in on that particular topic or any other can. So I'll go on to the next story. And I want to give a shout out to Brother Marty Owens out in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who had me on his program last night to talk about this particular story. But as you know, what I do is I try to put a bigger picture in sight. I was also with another guest by the name of Matt, and I can't remember his last name at this point, but he's been involved in the Freedom of Information Act to be able to get a lot of these police videos that they refuse to release. In any case, I want to read this part of this story that came out of Minnesota CBS Local. It says, police say there was a deadly officer-involved shooting early Saturday night in North Minneapolis. The fatal shooting happened in the area of 4700 block of Bryant Avenue North. Police say an anonymous 911 call came in just before 6:30 p.m. in which the call gave a detailed description of the suspect who was firing off a handgun. A second 911 call gave similar details, adding that the man was firing a silver 9mm handgun into the air and into the ground. Man, they're trying to make this sound like it was something off a Marvel comic book. What's that, Luke Cage? In any case, officers arrived at the scene and a foot chase ensued, leading to the suspect being shot. He was pronounced dead at the scene. At least five city blocks were covered with crime scene tape due to the length of the foot chase. Police say the two officers involved in the shooting were wearing body-worn cameras that were activated. The number of shots fired is not clear. The name of the victim has not been released by authorities as of late Saturday night. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is in charge of the investigation, which is standard procedure in an officer-involved shooting. About 100 people gathered at the scene Saturday night in a peaceful protest. And I'd like to add that one of the people that was gathered there and leading that was Sister Nakima Levy Pounds, also known as the abolitionist attorney. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey released this statement Saturday night. He says, I want to offer words that can help ease the pain that people in every neighborhood of our city feel tonight. But at the same time, I must recognize that whatever words I come up with will fall short of that goal. Regardless of what happened, too many times, people from across Minneapolis and the Twin Cities have been stung by the pain of the life lost in the course of an encounter with law enforcement. Regardless of what happened tonight, the historical trauma inflicted on communities of color is never far from nearly every facet of our life. Tonight we grieve as our memories are stirred by a now too familiar feeling, the loss of someone's son, brother, friend, and neighbor. Events of the past several years and now tonight have tested our city in ways that are new to some neighborhoods but are all too familiar for others. Strained relations between law enforcement officials and the communities they serve, especially communities of color, have exacted a toll on the very soul of our city, our region, and this nation. There's a little bit more to it. You can read it on New Abolitionist Radio, but I'm not going to repeat this mayor's statements at this point. I just don't feel comfortable with it because he's only pandering from what it sounds like to me. Like, he's really not saying, what are you going to do about it? We did some research on the program I released it where we showed how blacks are overwhelmingly more likely to be killed in Minneapolis, Minnesota than whites, and it happens often now. They've got a number of murders already just in the recent history. We're talking about the brother who's, Scotty, help me out with the brother who's was murdered with his fiance right next to him and his daughter in the back seat.
Philando Castile.
Told the man he had a gun. What was his name, Scotty?
Philando Castile.
Philando Castile, exactly, yes. So that was out there in the same area, and it's a few others with a brother by the name of Jamal who was killed. But in any case, they have been suffering through this police killings now for at least the past two decades on a recorded level. Scotty?
Max, we felt the same way about the words of that mayor. And not just this mayor as an individual, but I'm noticing a pattern as a person who pays attention to the media and just their techniques and how they deliver the so-called news, or more accurately, state propaganda. How come they never refer to these as American communities or simply communities? It's always people of color, color communities, and what have you. So that can mean that's like saying we're not recognizing you as American. I've again been studying Malcolm X here lately and came across, you know, some of his talk about they don't view you as an American. We're not even applying American to you because you ain't American. Not American the way we mean it, the way we mean it when we say we white. And why do these politicians get away with creating these divisions? Because that's automatically what they're doing. They're trying to say you something other. These are human beings. We're talking about human rights. And these are communities. What difference do it make the color of their skin? It's like some Jedi mind tricks. It's like, in the name of recognizing your pain, we're going to talk about you in a way that really signals that you ain't, you know, you something other. You're not an American, as we would like to refer to ourselves. You're not a citizen. You a community of color. And again, that could mean refugees or N-words. So, Max, that's all I got to say. I wasn't feeling them words either.
Yeah, man, it's just a lot of empty rhetoric, Scotty. That's how I see it. I mean, if you're not doing nothing about the core issues, then what are you talking about? We don't need your damn sympathy. If anything, just get the hell out of our way and let us get something done. But at every turn, we're fought against in every way, shape, or form. I mean, all we're trying to do is get freaking freedom and peace. What do you want? In any case, Scotty, I'll keep it moving. You know, there's a trilogy of films, documentaries, that I highly recommend that anyone who considers themselves an abolitionist or want to understand the abolitionist movement or the abolitionist goals or any of that should see these three films in successive order. The first film is Slavery by Another Name, PBS. It's available for free. You can see it at any time, and it tells you how all of this came to be through the past and the 13th Amendment and convict leasing. You can hear in the people's own words what happened during that period. The second is 13th by Ava DuVernay, which shows you how, from Slavery by Another Name, it's continued throughout the modern age through the 21st century, allowed by the 13th Amendment and leading to the largest prison population in the history of humanity on Earth. So the 13th tells you where we're at today. And then the final is called Do Not Resist. Do Not Resist is a documentary that projects by showing you what technologies and actions we are taking right now, where we're going for the future. They predicted certain technologies that we'll probably talk about tonight will come into play. And if you heard us talk about Do Not Resist before, in one of the clips, one of the people who is responsible for what they call predictive policing, where a computer basically gives you a color coding of whether or not you're going to be a criminal, and with face recognition and tied into it, where he tells you that they can determine whether or not your unborn child is going to be a murderer, and they have to figure out what to do with that information. That's predictive policing and Do Not Resist. It tells you where we're going. And there's a clip that I pulled out from that, Scotty. I'm going to get the URL for you to play it. It's on a Facebook. I know you had a problem with that last time. Hopefully you won't this time. But it's only a couple minutes long, and I just want people to hear what they're saying, and I'll explain what it's about afterwards. Scotty?
Yeah, give me just a sec. Keep talking, Max, while I pull it up.
Okay, well, let me give you the lead-in. This is what you'll be hearing is a gentleman by the name of Dave Grossman, and he is a police training expert. He's been doing it for like 20 years. During a seminar, and this is a clip from Do Not Resist, he was explaining to the police who they are and what they're about. And his books are required reading at the FBI Academy and police and sheriff offices across the nation. And he explains exactly what these police are all about.
The policeman is the man of the city. Heard of the mountain man, the frontiersman? Nobody talked about frontiersmen anymore. We still talk about policemen. You are to your city, your county, your state, but the frontiersman was the frontier. You are to your city, your county. You fight violence. What do you fight it with? Superior violence. What do you fight it with? Righteous violence, yeah? Violence is your tool. Violence is your enemy. Violence is a realm we operate in. You are men and women of violence. You must master it, or it will destroy you, yeah? Well, I've been on the road for 18 years. People know me. They trust me. I get a depth of information. I ask questions other people won't ask. Cop says, knock down, drag out, fight, cuffed them and stuffed them. Finally get home at the end of the shift, and cop says, gunfight, bad guys down. I'm alive. Finally get home at the end of the incident, and they all say, the best sex I've had in months. Both partners are very invested in some very intense sex. But there's not a whole lot of perks that come with this job. You find one, relax, and enjoy it. Thank you for taking and keeping. Anybody here from prison, probation, jail? Because I honor you. I publicly honor you. You look in the eyes of scary people every day, and you know the world's a better place is behind bars, yes? So you do this. On your way home that night, park your vehicle on the overpass for just a minute. Step out of your vehicle for just a minute. Look out on your city. Look at your citizens going about their lives. And know deep in your gut that today, at the risk of your life, you made their world a better place, whether they know it or not. Then walk up that bridge rail, put your hands on that rail, look out on your city, and let your cape blow in the wind. Thanks, guys. Thanks. Hurrah.
Easy. Go, let's go. Easy now, boys. Let's go. Breathe. Let's go. Get it done.
we all get amped up going on, if we do a regular warrant. You know, we all get the feeling, the adrenaline going, but like you don't get the butterfly you do on the start line for any of these events. It's just different.
Get in, let's go!
I remember the first search warrant, you're riding on the outside of these armored vehicles. I remember the first time I did it, I'm just trying not to smile. Like, it was just so much fun. I thought it was so cool. And so now every time we get new guys, and we call them pups, we call them SWAT pups, and I'm always watching them. The first time they go on a search warrant and they're on the outside of the vehicles, I always look for them, and they're always just smiling ear to ear. You know, they just feel like they're on top of the world.
Well, there you have it. That is from Do Not Resist. It's a clip of Dave Grossman, a police training expert, actually giving them these pep talks about who they are and what they're about. And then the last part that you heard was a clip from a training exercise that they do out in Florida, I believe, where all these SWAT teams come together and do these trainings. And the policeman himself told you what they do it for, what they're about. You know, it's the excitement of getting on the side of this big-ass tank and riding down the street to go, submit your first warrant or search warrant. And they show you also throughout that film what those search warrants do, where they go to with these search warrants. So you can imagine a couple of rookies riding on the side of the SWAT team vehicle as they rode over to kill Ayanna Jones, or as they threw that flash grenade into a little one-year-old baby's face. You know, the same smile and excitement of the search warrant. Scotty? And don't let me get started on the superhero aspect. These bastards think they're freaking superheroes, like Luke Cage. Not even Luke Cage. Let's go with the Punisher. And I say the Punisher literally because a police station in Kentucky put the Punisher logo on their freaking vehicles. Literally put the Punisher logo on their vehicles. They just think they are vigilantes outside of the law, can do anything they want to anybody. I mean, testosterone much? Scotty?
Yeah, you mentioned testosterone, and it is police who have, of course, anonymously admitted that there's a steroid problem, and we're dealing with a lot of roid rage, and he's not talking about that aspect. But, I mean, that was just blatantly disgusting, the dehumanizing language he was using. Pretty much along the lines when I interviewed this author, I can't remember his name right now, but he authored a book called Kill Anything That Moves or Kill Everything That Moves. And he talked about the brainwashing that Vietnam U.S. soldiers sent to kill Vietnamese people, the training that they was given. They were specifically officers told not to refer to the Vietnamese as people, or call them Vietnamese, or anything that just gooks and kites and whatever, you know, dehumanizing terms. We've seen that throughout recent wars in the Middle East, ragheads and sand N-words, and you know, that's what it reminds me of. And then when you look at the statistics, and you name some of their victims, Ayanna Jones, you know, Black Talk Radio participated heavily in the promotion of that case back in the day, once working, you know, with some activists. Well, two New York activists that staged a march and protest in her name in Detroit. But you know, that's what he sound like. He sound like they in a war zone. So that's why I say we behind enemy lines when I open up Black Talk Radio Network. I've been in the military. I know the attitude. I know the mentality when I see it. And then let's not forget many of these Israelis who are waging war against the Palestinian people to prevent them from reclaiming their homelands, come over here and give American slave catchers tips on how they deal with Palestinians, which we've seen here with this march of right of return to their homelands is resulted in thousands of them being killed, and well, not killed, hundreds of them killed, but thousands of them maimed, wounded, casualties of war. So as I was listening to Tanya Free and Friends and earlier today, and she mentioned that this is civil war. And David Clark, one of our least favorite people in the world, straight up unapologetic slaver, who people died under his watch at the Milwaukee jail that he resigned from under a cloud of investigations of that department. He has told these Trump supporters, this is a civil war, the leftists waging war. Alex Jones talking about socialists and communists is waging war. It's a civil war, civil war, civil war. We are, it is war. We are in a war. The Civil War, the American Civil War, which was fought by many who signed up and volunteered to end slavery, has not been decided. Lincoln capitulated. So again, warlike language, militarizing the police to go out there and kill people. But again, the statistics are that at least 60%, and that's probably conservatively, 60% of people in American prisons are in there for nonviolent offenses, like from the drug war, like from whether or not circumstances made them engage in prostitution, or whether they was even victims and forced into it. It's many of them in prison and what have you. So yeah, Max, very disgusting. So that should tell you, in the clip that I played for y'all, the video said that this is required reading. This book, this sociopath or psychopath, I'm not a psychiatrist, so maybe he's a little both, but wrote, is required reading at the FBI Academy and police departments around the country. So again, that slave master mentality being indoctrinated into the slave catchers. Max, tossing it back to you.
Yeah, Scotty, it's amazing, man. As the increase for slave catchers rises, so does the amount of human bodies it requires them to catch and fill these facilities. Just to back up all of that, I want to read a little bit from The Week in 2015, where they did a study, and they found that SWAT teams have spiked from around 3,000 strikes per year in 1980 to as many as 80,000 raids a year now. And, you know, on that film, Do Not Resist, as I said, they show you who they're raiding. People living in freaking trailers and in poverty and breaking their doors down and terrorizing people. But in any case, let me give you a few examples. SWAT teams are used for today. A SWAT team was deployed in Fairfax, Virginia, to take down an optometrist who was guilty of making bets on football games. Another one is, in Arizona, a SWAT team ransacked, revealed that a local man was keeping chickens in his backyard. All the chickens were killed. In Florida, it took a judge's order to stop the Orange County Sheriff's Office from sending paramilitary teams out to take down an unlicensed barbershop, holding customers at barbershops at gunpoint. In New Mexico, a SWAT team pursued a suicidal man, saved him from killing himself by doing the job themselves. And in Georgia, a SWAT team targeted an errant DJ in Illinois. One stalked a politician on Twitter. This is what SWAT teams are being used for, because he mocked a man on Twitter. Just outrageous, Scotty. And it makes me wonder, why people think they can fix a crime against humanity. It leads me to, I guess, now that we have a few minutes to spare, I would still like to read the speech I was talking about earlier, and it was written by William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist. Find the page right now, Scotty. I'll pull it up. I think I just
okay. Why are you pulling that up? Why are you pulling that up? Let me just recall, I think Joe Arpaio actually, they purchased a tank. I mean, that's a military tank. And I remember Steven Seagal even going down there to support his bid to become sheriff. This man was sheriff in Maricopa County, Arizona for 20 to 30 years. I'm talking about the man that Trump pardoned because he was found guilty of violating a court's order in his treatment of refugees. But he had a tank. I remember Steven Seagal taking pictures on the tank and what have you. And Steven Seagal has even participated in the promotion and producing propaganda for these slave catchers.
Yes, Scotty. And you know, in that film, Do Not Resist, they talk about the instances of how we came to be so well armed within our police departments. And they really insinuated, and I think it's true, that it was money laundering going on. Because a lot of these police stations and sheriff stations, like out here in Columbia, they got a couple of two tanks, but they only had one sheriff. A one sheriff town had two tanks. They were getting them for free. It really was like money laundering. Is giving to the local police station hire these military vehicles, which they used vehicles that had Afghanistan. But in the film, they point out that 45% of those that were shipped to these were fresh off the assembly line. So they had nothing to do with used vehicles from wars. They were literally arming police stations and sheriff offices against something. And what are you arming people with tanks against? It damn sure ain't the average person, that's for sure. So, anyway, let me get into this speech that I've been wanting to read. It's from William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist. And I think, man, that he is speaking our minds, Scotty Reed. So I'm going to start out with that. That to be an abolitionist is not to be with the multitude, on the side of the majority, in a popular and respected position. And yet, I think I have the right to ask you and all men living on the soil of the Empire State and of the people of the North at large, why is it that you shrink from the name of abolitionists? Why is it that, while you profess to be opposed to slavery, you nevertheless desire the whole land that you are not radical abolitionists? What is the meaning of this? Why are you not abolitionists? Your principles are mine. What you have taught me, I adopt. What you have an oath to support as a measure of government, I recognize as right and just. Profess to believe in the Declaration of Independence. That is my abolition. Every man, therefore, who disclaims it repudiates the Declaration of Independence, does he not? All men created equal, endowed by their Creator with the unalienable right to liberty. Gentlemen, that is my fanaticism. All I ask is that the Declaration may be carried out everywhere in our country and throughout the world. It belongs to mankind. Your Constitution is an abolitionist Constitution. Your laws are abolitionist laws. Your institutions, your free schools are abolition-free schools. I believe in them all, and all that I ask is that institutions so good, so free, so noble may be everywhere propagated. Everywhere accepted, and thus it is that I desire not to curse the South or any portion of it, but to bless her abundantly by abolishing her infamous and demoralizing slave institutions and erecting the Temple of Liberty on the ruins thereof. I believe, but it is the democracy which recognizes man as man the world over. It is the democracy which exists all for all wearing the human form. And so I say that any man who pretends to be a Democrat and yet apologizes for making man the property of his fellow men is a dissembler and hypocrite, and I unmask him before the universe. William Lloyd Garrison, The Abolitionists and Their Relations to the War. You can read that speech in its entirety on New Abolitionist Radio. Scotty?
He just talking about people's hypocrisy, no different than Frederick Douglass saying, what is the Emancipation Proclamation? to the Negro, or what is the 4th of July to the Negro. He talked about both. We just talked about it last week about the cognitive dissonance associated with celebrating Juneteenth when slavery has never been abolished. And so he just talking about the hypocrites of his day. I suspect he, when he say Democrats, he means a person who professes to believe in democracy and the Declaration of Independence and the human rights that are codified within that, but to that point was not being applied to human beings. No recognizing of non-white people's human rights. And so he's just calling out the hypocrisy of his day, something that we are of no short supply of in 2018. Max.
Yeah, Scott, he definitely was. But as I said, you know, he mimics what we're thinking here. We're like, why are you not abolitionists? I mean, I don't understand it. What are you talking about reform? I mean, if somebody was in the process of molesting your children, you wouldn't be talking about let's reform molestation. I mean, you wouldn't be saying about murder. You wouldn't be saying about any other crime. But you get to say it about slavery, and I don't understand that. You know, I don't understand it at all. And we've often talked about the differences between slavery abolitionists, between reformers, between prison abolitionists. And I pointed out just the other day in regards to what's going on with the human trafficking, with the children in adoption agencies and foster parenting system, how that is legalized slavery here in the United States. But that wouldn't be a talking point in prison abolitionists because they only focus on the prison as the problem. When the prisons isn't just a problem, they're part of the problem. The problem is leaving the United States of America, allowed by the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and in practice since 1865. With the advent of convict leasing, that has went on all the way up till today. It's why we warehouse human bodies in prisons for any cost from as much as $30,000 a year to up to more than $250,000 a year per person. They work them also. You know, I was listening to a program recently. It was the Shark Tank, you know, when you go in for your businesses and stuff like that. And they got this one brother on there. I don't know his name, but I heard him talking to this potential person that they would finance. And he was talking about how, if, you know, we get your product, we can take it overseas and set up places where we can have distribution and production with no problem at all. He wasn't talking about creating American jobs. This brother was talking about sending them over to Indonesia or Mexico, where they could exploit the labor and the children and the communities there instead of doing it here. Scotty?
Very astute observation, Max. Again, perhaps he was referring to what we heard in the other clip about the standard international business practices of slavery. So, yeah, that's perhaps what he was referring to, Max.
You know, as I've mentioned here on New Abolitionist Radio, I saw my entire community be destroyed by those very same ideas. When we fought for jobs during the civil rights efforts of the 1950s, late 1950s and 1960s, over the time, everything that we have really gained has been lost. I think I hear music there, so I'm figuring that Scotty wants me to go to the break. Is that correct, Scotty? If that's the case, you're listening to New Abolitionist Radio here at Black Talk Radio Network. We're live and on the spot. We'll be right back after these messages.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
Peace and welcome back to New Abolitionist Radio. Don't worry about me finishing my thought from before. Let's just move on. Scotty, it's time for our final segments of the evening, and we might have a couple minutes if anybody wants to call in. Now would be a good time. In any case, would you like to pick one that you want to do, Scotty, the abolitionist in profile or the rider of the 21st Century Underground Railroad?
We do have a caller from area code 646, so while they chime in, I will pull up the abolitionist in profile.
Peace and welcome to New Abolitionist Radio. State your name, where you're calling from, and question or comment.
Peace. This is Ted. Salute to y'all and to abolitionists.
You made me unmute? Oh, there you go. Hey, what's up, Tag?
Peace. Yeah, welcome really home, brother. Appreciate that, Brother Max. And feeling the broadcast, and I'm glad that you pulled up that snippet from the film, because, you know, as was mentioned, it's just such a clear-cut example of, you know, the psychopathic kind of rhetoric and thinking, you know, that's promoted so clearly. And it's just a very blatant example of, you know, white propaganda, of just kind of raising up this attitude of, you know, controlling cities and all, you know, look upon your city, et cetera. And it was just, you know, this is the kind of thing that we see. And as far as, you know, why more abolitionists aren't out there, you know, I would agree with y'all's analysis of it, and it seems like a lot of it boils down essentially to just fear, you know, the fear that is inculcated in most everyone as regards these slave patrollers, and then also those that the slave patrollers target, you know, the most. So, you know, the notion that those, you know, such as those who are street homeless, those who are, you know, out here, you know, involved in street families and the like, you know, are so criminalized, are made to seem so demonized, you know, that it just kind of ramps up exponentially the overall sense of fear. And so there's this belief that there needs to be that so-called thin blue line, you know, to protect, you know, the innocents or whatever. And I was reminded, I would draw again from this book that I'm nowhere near through putting down notes around, but it's a book called Slave Patrollers that I had referenced earlier on the network by Sally Haddon. And I just came across like a quote that I had written down from it. It's from page 77, and it just speaks directly to why it is perhaps that these patrollers feel so emboldened to do what they do. And it says, "Receiving legal authority to act as patrollers helped define their status in the white community, and official status provided patrollers indemnity against civil or criminal lawsuits brought by slaveholders who disapproved of their brutal methods." So we're talking about, you know, 17th century patrollers, you know, at that time, basically having the same kind of, you know, immunity and sense of just free, you know, freewheeling out here without any legal recourse that we see to this day, you know.
All right, Tag, appreciate your analysis and sharing that information. And it's just a linear continuation of slavery, not just through law and societal practices, but that mentality and the way that we have seen the most effective way to institute slavery or enslave human beings is through extreme violence. So it's always going to be that component. Max?
It's always going to be that component. Max?
He just reminded me of Atlanta's first black police officers who were explicitly told that they could not arrest white people. Explicitly told that. And then also, you know, I was saying something couple of days ago along this line, that if you teach the sheep to run the slaughterhouse, that's not a better slaughterhouse, because that's what's happening with especially with police of color, you're just supporting your own genocide and participating in it gleefully. And, you know, a lot of us think that, you know, if we do 98% of the stuff we do is all good, we can get away with 2% of stuff that is crimes against humanity. It just doesn't work out that way. You know, I once posited the idea mathematically that if there's 1 million police officers and they average about 3 false arrests a year, that's 3 million people in prison because you made a false arrest or an unjust arrest, or you followed some kind of law that's enacted like sagging pants laws that ends up with people being tased to freaking death in a jail cell. Just 3 a year. And some of you guys who are cops have worked 20, 30 years in police forces. You don't think you made 3 mistakes? That adds up to 3 million people. It's a collective issue. It just grows and grows and grows. Scotty, I know you got the abolitionist in profile. I just want to also point out something about that. I've had some issues as of late with the Quaker community and them paying lip service, basically, is the way I see it, not actually doing what they said they would do. But in any case, that does not take us away from the opportunity to show respect for the Quakers who led the way as abolitionists. I just wish that that community today would look at those people from the past and follow suit as what they did. Scotty.
Again, we're talking about a continuation of a mindset, the mindset of the slave catcher in the slaver class has perpetuated itself throughout so-called American history or U.S. history. And unfortunately, the mindset of the abolitionist is not as common, and it has not been handed down linear to a large number of people. But, you know, we just got to keep recruiting. We have to look at it again as war. So you got to recruit soldiers just like the United States military does. They got me with that GI Bill, okay? So, you know, we don't have no money to hand out to people, but we do have a just cause, and that cause is ending slavery. And our abolitionists, and speaking of ending slavery and being a soldier, Prudence Crandall is our abolitionist in profile tonight. Prudence Crandall, 1803 to 1890. So she was 97, excuse me, yeah, 87 years old when she transitioned. Prudence Crandall, a Quaker abolitionist and teacher, Prudence Crandall bravely defied prevailing patterns of racial discrimination when she opened one of her first schools for African-American girls in Connecticut in 1833. Though supported by leading anti-slavery activists, among them William Lloyd Garrison, the speech from which Max read earlier was written by him, Crandall, a white woman, faced legal harassment and social ridicule for efforts to educate free blacks in the North. Born in Hopkinton, Rhode Island on September 3rd, 1803, the farmers Pardon and Esther Carpenter Crandall, Prudence Crandall, moved with her family to Canterbury, Connecticut when she was 10 years old. She attended the New England Friends Boarding School in Providence, where she studied arithmetic, Latin, and science subjects not typically for women but embraced by Quakers who believed in equal educational opportunities. She taught briefly in Plainfield and in 1831 opened a private girls' academy in Canterbury, where she initially taught daughters from the town's wealthiest families. Ranked as one of the state's best schools, her rigorous curriculum provided female students with an education comparable that of prominent schools for boys. In 1832, Crandall admitted Sarah Harris, an African-American woman from a successful family who sought to become a teacher. Local white parents were outraged, urging Crandall to expel Harris. She refused. When white parents withdrew their children, Crandall transformed her boarding school into one for African-American girls. That, too, met with hostility from local white men who feared that it would draw more African-Americans into their community and would lead to interracial marriage. Fear of genetic annihilation, talk about that linear mindset, Garrison, editor of The Liberator, the nation's major anti-slavery newspaper, helped Crandall School by advertising it and by linking Crandall with prominent African-American families interested in sending their daughters to her school. White Canterbury townspeople continuously protested, confronting, that's a topic of conversation, or whether or not we should confront fascists in restaurants or at gas stations or whatnot. These people were confronting Miss Crandall. When African American students ventured beyond the school, they were met with taunts, threats, and violence. Some whites pelted them with eggs, stones, or manure. When Crandall continued undaunted, the Canterbury legislature passed its 1833 Black Law. So, and it's in quotations, but it was later repealed in 1838. But the Black Law, okay, Black Codes, that just simply means that a legislator passed a law signed into law by a governor, and since we're talking state legislature, and then enforced by the quote-unquote law enforcement's key cog in enforcing slavery and white supremacy. So they passed this law making it illegal to run a school teaching African-American students from a state other than Connecticut. Crandall was arrested in jail. Her first trial ended in a hung jury. The second trial resulted in her conviction, which was overturned by a higher court. On the night of September 9th, 1834, an angry mob broke most of the school's windows and smashed furniture. Fearing for her student's safety, Crandall finally closed the school. In 1835, Crandall married Baptist minister and abolitionist Calvin Filio. The couple left Connecticut, ultimately settling in LaSalle County, Illinois. I think that's the same county. No, Cook County is Chicago. Where Crandall then ran a school and participated in the women's suffrage movement. That means demanding the right to vote. After her husband's death in 1874, she moved to Elk Falls, Kansas to live with her brother. In 1886, prompted by repentant Canterbury citizens and Hartford resident author Mark Twain, Crandall received a small pension from the Connecticut legislature. In other words, she got reparations. Recognizing her as a white woman, but none of their other victims got reparations. This is not Miss Crandall's fault, but just a point of note. Her Canterbury school now houses the Prudence Crandall Museum, and she was named Connecticut State Heroine. And that was edited by Deborah Michaels, PhD. And I will toss back to Max so that he can give us our writer of the 21st Underground Railroad. Yes, Max.
Indeed. Salute to the abolitionists. Scotty, thank you very much. All right. I'm going to try to squeeze this in quickly because there is one other thing I do want to touch on after this. This is our rider of the 21st Century Underground Railroad, and it occurred on Juneteenth of 2018. The Innocence Project New Orleans IPNO client Gerald Manning walked out of prison at age 59 as a free man, the first time he's experienced freedom in his adult life. Manning spent 52 years in a prison for a crime he did not commit. In 1977, at age 17, Manning was convicted of raping and murdering Vonda Harris. Manning confessed to the crime after police interrogated him for 33 hours without a lawyer or parent present. Manning maintained he had provided police with a false confession. The confession, however, became the only evidence used to convict him. At only 17 years old, Manning was convicted of attempted aggravated rape and second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Manning was not alone in fighting for his innocence. Upon reading through the case, Harris' daughter, Rondalyn, became convinced of Manning's innocence. To further investigate her mother's murder, Rondalyn took a job at the courthouse. If the trial transcripts was like a movie, I read it from the beginning to end, and that's where I came up with my conclusion that he didn't do it, Rondalyn told local news. In April of 2018, Manning's lawyers sought post-conviction relief based on exculpatory DNA evidence and a flawed police investigation. last week in an agreement with the Ouachita Parish District Attorney's Office, Manning accepted an Alford plea and was resentenced to time served. When Manning was released last week, Ronlin could not have been happier. All the prayers and tears we done shed. It feels good because who wants someone incarcerated for the murder of your mom that didn't even commit it? I don't see how they slept at night because I couldn't even sleep at night, she told the local news. Harris's family is currently trying to have the case reopened and to locate the actual perpetrator, while Manning is beginning to rebuild his life after spending 42 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And we here at New Abolitionist Radio would like to say welcome to freedom.
Welcome to freedom. Gerald Mack. Welcome to freedom. Max, real quick, Max, I know you said you got something to get into, but we do have a caller. Caller, you have 2 minutes, because we're very, very short on time. But area code 717, thank you for calling in the New Abolitionist Radio. Please share your thoughts with us.
This is Brother Davis, man. I'm sorry I'm late, and I know it's at the back end because I had things to do, but the show that I caught was great. I'm going to encourage everybody to go out and at least see those. If you haven't seen the three documentaries that he's talking about, they all are powerful. They all have a direct effect on us. And once again, brothers, I want to say thank you for a great show.
And thank you, Brother Davis, for that endorsement. I'm going to toss it back to you, Max. We have about, 6 minutes, 6-7 minutes to do your thing, and then we have our final comments. Max.
Yes, sir, Scotty. The thing that I almost forgot is I wanted to address a particular issue that also happened on Juneteenth. On Juneteenth, the ACLU released an article called Americans Are at Risk of Forgetting Slavery and Repeating Our Mistakes. And it was by Edward C. Davis IV. He's a professor of Africana Studies and Anthropology from the Malcolm X College, City Colleges of Chicago. And as I said, it came out on the 19th. And apparently what he had done to jog his memory of how we are perpetuating slavery is a visit to the Alabama Museum that was started by Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative. Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative. And by going to visit this museum, which showed the tales of Jim Crow and lynching laws and things like that, it really jogged his memory, apparently. And he wanted to warn us that we may end up making those same mistakes. What I would like to say to the gentleman and to the ACLU is this. You are fully damn aware of the 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. You would jump on any other constitution, the first, the second, the fifth, the fourth, the 25th, the 99th, if there was one, anything but the 13th Amendment. And then you got the gall to come out and tell us about how we're going to repeat, because we have, as a population, forgotten, we're going to repeat slavery through our mistakes. We are already there. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. We have the largest prison population in the history of humanity on planet Earth. There's more black men in jails and prisons right now than there were in cages and enslaved at the height of the chattel slavery system. So I don't know what you're talking about. You need to check the 13th Amendment. And I challenge you, ACLU, and anybody that wants to represent them, to take on this cause, because you should have done it already. Scotty, final comments?
I'll use my final comments to address the ACLU, while also, you know, just piggybacking off of your statement. So most of these chapters, the ACLU has a national branch, just like the NAACP, just like some of these other organizations. They have state branches. Some may even have county branches and what have you. And so North Carolina ACLU is run by a black woman. I think she just recently came into that position. And I did write a letter to the ACLU asking them to represent me as in an issue involved in the state of North Carolina in how it is a violation of the Constitution to force me to pay for some Confederate monuments on your courthouse grounds, your point of transition from so-called freedom, which is really, you know, oppression, into outright slavery through the prisons. And so they said they couldn't represent me. I'm not going to rehash that whole thing. But they have social media accounts, so I follow them. And when they bring up something, I tweet at them. Ah, what about that 13th, though? You know what I'm saying? And I try to, you know, codify my language, point it out in a strategic way, not an antagonistic way. But we just got to keep interjecting abolition in the conversation. Because even if they don't respond, other people come behind, see those tweets, see your tweet, and that thought then gets planted in another person's mind. So that's how you spread abolition. Keep spreading abolition. And because we always, like someone had said to me yesterday, they was like, we're always going to have slavery. And I said, I hope that there always be those to oppose slavery. So I hope that during this past 2 hours that we have convinced you to become part of the opposition to slavery and adopting and yourself into the new abolitionist movement. Max. Yourself into the new abolitionist movement. Max.
Indeed. I want to thank our callers for participating in the program tonight, Brother Tag and Sister Sharon Smith. And I'm going to end mine with a simple quote from Fannie Lou Hammer, which we talked about recently, Scotty Reed. And she said, I'll tell you why. I keep a shotgun in every corner of my bedroom, and the first cracker even look like he want to throw some dynamite on my porch won't write his mama again. Sometimes seems like to tell the truth today is to run the risk of being killed. But if I fall, I'll fall 5 feet, 4 inches forward in the fight for freedom. I'm not backing off. Fannie Lou Hammer. Remember, abolition is a reason for a revolution so we can finally know peace. Peace.
Rise up, rise up, rise up, rise up, rise up.
Just lift your eyes up, let your wise rise up. See the signs of the times if it's time. Rise up, rise up. When death and hell dwell among all God's people, when those we chose and trusted have become completely corrupted and inherently evil, when the feast that feeds you starves our father's children, when snuff, porn, and pedo forms begin to get top billing, rise up.